she'd done, but not Lito. She knew he would never have let her do it.
"I traded my trumpet," she confessed, "for the gasoline."
Her grandfather was shocked.
"But that trumpet was everything to you."
"No, not everything," Isabel thought. "It wasn't my mother and father, and you, Lito."
"I'll get another one in the States," she said.
Lito shook his head.
"Here, let's have a song anyway."
He began singing a salsa song and tapping out the rhythm on the side of the metal boat. Soon the whole boat was singing, and Lito stood and held out a hand to Amara, inviting her to dance.
"Papi, sit down! You'll fall out of the boat,"
Isabel's mother told him.
"I can't fall out of the boat, because I have already fallen for this princess of the sea," he said.
Amara laughed and took his hand, and the two of them danced as best they could in the swaying boat. Mommy started counting clave by clapping, and Isabel frowned, trying to follow the beat.
"Still can't hear it, Chavela?"
Lito asked. Isabel closed her eyes and focused. She could almost hear it. Almost. And then the motor spluttered and died, and the music stopped.
Mahmoud, Kilis, Turkey, 2015. 2 days from home. Mahmoud could hear music beyond the fence. It was hard to see for all the people. He stood in a long line with his family, waiting at the border to gain admission into Turkey near the city of Kilis. Around them were countless more Syrian families, all hoping to be let in. They carried everything they owned with them, sometimes in suitcases and duffel bags, but more often stuffed into pillowcases and trash bags. The men wore jeans and t-shirts and tracksuits. The women wore dresses and abayas and hijabs. Their children looked like miniature versions of them and acted like miniature adults, too. There was very little crying and whining, and none of the kids were playing. They had all walked too far and seen too much. After leaving the car behind, Mahmoud and his family had followed the map on their phone, skirting cities held by Daesh and the Syrian army and the rebels and the Kurds, as best they could. Google Maps told them it would be an 8-hour walk, and they split the journey up by sleeping in a field. It was hot out by day, but it got cold at night, and Mahmoud and his family had left all their extra clothes in the car, in their haste to escape. The next morning, they had seen the people. Dozens of them. Hundreds. Refugees, just like Mahmoud and his family, who had left their homes in Syria and were walking north to Turkey. To safety. Mahmoud and his family had fallen into step with them and disappeared among their ranks. Invisible. Just as Mahmoud liked it. Together, the shambling throng of refugees was ignored by the American drones and the rebel rocket launchers and the Syrian army tanks and the Russian jets. Mahmoud heard explosions and saw smoke clouds, but no one cared about a few hundred Syrian people leaving the battlefield. And now they were in line with him. All those hundreds of people and thousands more, and they weren't invisible anymore. Turkish guards in light green camo gear with automatic weapons and white surgical masks over their faces walked up and down the line, staring at each of them in turn. Mahmoud felt like he was in trouble. He wanted to look away, but he was worried that might make the guards think he was hiding something. But if he looked right at them, they would notice him, maybe pull him and his family out of line. Mahmoud stared straight ahead at his father's back instead. His father's shirt was stained at the armpits, and with a quick sniff of his own shirt, Mahmoud realized he stank too. They had walked for hours in the hot sun without a bath, without a change of clothes. They looked tired and poor and wretched. If he were a Turkish border guard, he wouldn't have let in any of these dirty, squalid people, himself included. Mahmoud's father kept their papers tucked into his pants under his shirt, along with all of their money. The only other things they owned now, besides two phones and two chargers. When Mahmoud and his family finally got to the front of the line, late in the day, Mahmoud's father presented their official documents to the border agent. After what seemed like an eternity of looking over their papers, the border guard finally stapled temporary visas onto their passports and let them through. They were in Turkey! Mahmoud couldn't believe it. Step after step, kilometer after kilometer, he'd begun to think they would never, ever escape Syria. But as relieved as he was, he knew they still had so very far to go. Ahead of them stretched a small city of white canvas tents, their pointed tops staggered like white caps on a choppy sea. There were no trees, no shade, no parks or football fields, or rivers. Just a sea of tents and a forest of electric poles and wires. "Hey, we're in luck," Mahmoud's dad joked. "The circus is in town." Mahmoud looked around. There was a main street in the camp, a wide lane where refugees had set up little shops, selling phone cards and camp stoves and clothes and things people had brought with them but no longer wanted or needed. It was like a giant rummage sale, and it seemed like everybody in the camp was there. The path was crammed full of Syrians, all strolling along like they had nothing else to do and nowhere else to go. "All right," Mahmoud's father was saying. "A man in the group we walked with gave me the name of a smuggler who can get us from Turkey to Greece." "A smuggler?" Mom said. Mahmoud didn't like the sound of that either. To him, smuggler meant illegal, and illegal meant dangerous. Dad waved their fears away. "It's fine. This is what they do. They get people into the EU. The EU, Mahmoud knew, was the European Union. He also knew they were much more strict about letting people in than Turkey was. Once you were in one of the EU countries, though, like Greece or Hungary or Germany, you could apply for asylum and be granted official refugee status. It was getting there that was the hard part. "I've been talking to him on WhatsApp," Dad continued, holding up his phone. "It will be expensive, but we can pay. And we'll have to get to Izmir on the Turkish coast. Assuming we stop to sleep every night, that's a 19-day walk. Or it's a 12-hour car ride non-stop. I'll see if I can find us a bus." Mahmoud and his mother and sister and brother walked the shopping street. People called out to one another in Arabic, and music from radios and TVs filled the air. Other children darted in and out among the adults, laughing and chasing each other into the alleys of tents off the main drag. Mahmoud caught himself smiling. After Aleppo, the near-constant gunfire and explosions, punctuated by the oppressive quiet of an entire city trying their hardest not to draw attention to themselves, this place felt alive, even if it was dusty and cramped. Mahmoud saw a cardboard box of used toys at one of the shops and knelt to dig in it, while his mother and brother and sister walked on. He sifted through it, hoping, yes, a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. It was the one with the red bandana. The box didn't have any other Ninja Turtles in it, but Walid would be excited to get it. Mahmoud hoped so, at least. Walid didn't seem to get excited about much these days. Mahmoud paid 10 Syrian pounds for it, about 5 cents in American money. A car honked behind Mahmoud, and he turned like everybody else. It was an old blue Opel taxi, traveling so slowly Mahmoud could walk faster. It was the only car Mahmoud had seen in the camp, and the crowd parted for it as it drew closer. A Syrian pop song blared from the radio, and young men and women danced and laughed alongside the taxi. As it passed, Mahmoud saw a young couple sitting in the back. The woman was dressed in a white satin dress and veil. It was a marriage procession, Mahmoud realized. Back in Syria, it was a tradition to be escorted to your wedding by a parade of cars to help carry you into your new life. Mahmoud remembered his uncle's wedding before the war. His uncle had worn a tuxedo, and his bride had worn a dress of sparkling jewels and a tiara, and they had been escorted by a dozen cars to a party where Mahmud had eaten a piece of the delicious seven-tiered cake and danced with his mother to a real band. Here, the couple's only escort was a group of rowdy teenage boys running behind the taxi, and their destination was a dirty white tent with whatever food they'd been able to buy in the camp's market. But everyone seemed to be having fun. The old taxi's exhaust pipe made a sound like a gunshot, puck, and everybody ducked instinctively. The spell of happiness and safety was momentarily broken by the unforgettable memories of the chaos they had just escaped. Mahmud's heart was still racing when someone put a hand on his shoulder and he jumped. It was his dad.
Mahmud, where's your mother? Where are Walid and Hannah?
His father asked.
I found us a ride, but we have to leave now.
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 10 days from home. Joseph followed the small group of kids through the raised doorway onto the bridge of the St. Louis. The bridge was a narrow, curving room that stretched from one side of the ship to the other. Bright sunlight streamed in through 2 dozen windows, offering a panoramic view of the vast, blue-green Atlantic and wispy white clouds. Throughout the wood-decked room were metal benches with maps and rulers on them, and the walls were dotted with mysterious gauges and meters made of shining brass. There were a number of crewmen on the bridge, some of them wearing blue and white sailor uniforms like the stewards, and 3 more in brass-buttoned blue jackets with gold bands at the cuffs and blue officers' caps with gold trim. One of the regular sailors stood at a spoked steering wheel the size of a truck tire, with handles sticking out all around it. It looked like the steering wheels Joseph had seen in paintings of pirate ships, but this one was metal and connected to a big rectangular pedestal. The shortest of the 3 men in fancy uniforms strode over to the group with a big smile on his face. Joseph recognized him from the Shabbos service.
"Welcome to the bridge, boys and girls," he said. "I'm Captain Schroeder."
The captain shook each of their hands, even though none of them was older than 13. One of the parents on board the ship had arranged for a tour of the bridge and engine room for any children who wanted to attend, and 8 of them had signed up. Ruthie and Evelina hadn't been interested, but Renata was there, along with a few of the other older kids. Captain Schroeder introduced them to his first officer and the other crew on the bridge, and showed them what some of the gauges and dials meant. Joseph listened eagerly.
"This is the engine control for the St. Louis," Captain Schroeder explained. "When we want to change speed, we grip these handles, slide them all the way forward, and then pull them back to the new setting." He smiled. "I'm not going to change the speed now, because we've got the engines set right where we want them."
Joseph noticed both handles were set to ahead full. "Are we going full speed because we're racing 2 other ships to Cuba?" Joseph asked. The captain looked surprised, and then a little angry.
"Where did you hear that we're racing other ships to Cuba?" he asked Joseph.
2 stewards were talking about it the other day," Joseph said, feeling a little nervous. "They said if we don't make it there first, they might not let us in."
The captain pursed his lips and glanced meaningfully at his first officer, who looked concerned. The captain turned on his smile again.
"We're not in any kind of race," he said, looking from Joseph to the other kids. "We're just making best possible speed because we have calm seas and a following wind. You've nothing to worry about. Now perhaps Petty Officer Yockel will show you the engine room."
As high up as the bridge was on the ship, the engine room was just as far down. After stepping through a steel fire door that had "Crew Only" painted on it in big letters, Joseph and the tour group went down staircase after staircase, and they still weren't to the engine room yet. Below decks was very different from what Joseph was used to above decks, where everything on A, B, and C decks was airy and comfortable. There were no portholes here, no spacious cabins. The air was damp and smelled of cigarettes and cabbage and sweat. Peeking into the rooms, Joseph could see that the crew quarters below decks had 2 beds to a room and barely enough space to turn around. The hallways were narrow and the ceilings were low.
Petty Officer Yockel had to duck as they went through doorways. Yosef had never been afraid of tight places before, but the close living conditions made him uneasy. He felt like he was visiting an alien world. The 7 other kids must have felt the same way, because they were all silent, even Renata. From down the hall came the sound of men singing, and Petty Officer Yockel slowed. As they got closer, Joseph recognized the tune. It was the Horst Wessel song, the anthem of the Nazi party. Joseph's skin crawled, and he and the other kids looked at each other nervously. Joseph had heard the Horst Wessel song hundreds of times in the weeks following his father's abduction. It had gone overnight from an obscure song the Nazis sang at rallies to the unofficial national anthem of Germany, and it was frightening. The last time Joseph had heard the song was the day every one of his neighbors had lined the street to salute as Nazi soldiers marched by. Petty Officer Yockel tried to slip the children past the little common room where the crewmen were drinking and singing, but suddenly someone in the room called out,
"Stop! Passengers aren't allowed down here!"
Yockel froze, and so did Joseph. One of the men got up from the table, a scowl on his face. He was a thick-set man with a bulbous nose, bulldog cheeks, and dark, heavy eyebrows. Joseph knew that face from somewhere. Had he been their steward at dinner? Set up their beds one night? No. Joseph remembered. This was the man he had seen in the balcony the morning of the Shabbos service, the man who had been angry that the portrait of Hitler had been taken down and removed. The man staggered a little, bumping into things as he tried to move through the tight little room. Joseph had seen drunk people leaving pubs in Berlin the same way.
"The captain has given these children special permission to visit the engine room, Schindick," Petty Officer Yockel told him.
"The captain," Schindick said, his voice dripping with disapproval.
Even from where Joseph stood, he could smell the alcohol on his breath.
"Yes," Yockel said, straightening. "The captain."
On the wall of the common room, Joseph saw a bulletin board with Nazi slogans and headlines from the rabidly anti-Jewish newspaper Der Stürmer pinned to it. He felt a shiver of fear.
"Jewish rats," Schindick said, sneering at Joseph and the other kids.
Many of them looked at their shoes, and even Joseph looked away, trying not to draw the big man's attention. Joseph clenched his fists, and his ears burned hot with frustration and embarrassment at his helplessness. After a few tense moments, Schindick staggered back to his seat, the threat of the captain's rank still worth something, even so far away from the bridge. Petty Officer Yockel hurried the children along, and Schindick and his friends broke into another Nazi song, even louder than before. Joseph heard them sing, "When Jewish blood flows from the knife, things will go much better," before Yockel ushered them down another flight of stairs. Joseph's legs felt weak, and he clung to the railing. He thought they had escaped all this on the St. Louis, but the hatred had followed them even here, to the middle of the ocean. With its huge diesel engines and generators and dials and pumps and switches, the engine room should have been fascinating, but Joseph had a hard time getting excited about it. None of the other children were excited either. Not after what had happened with Schindick. The tour ended solemnly, and Petty Officer Yockel returned them to the surface, being careful to take them back by a different route. It was a different world below decks, Joseph thought, a world outside the magic little bubble he and the other Jews lived in above decks on the MS St. Louis. Here, below decks, was the real world.
Isabel, the Straits of Florida, somewhere north of Cuba. 1994. One day from home. Isabel watched as Papi, Señor Castillo, Luis, and Amara huddled over the boat engine, trying to figure out why it wouldn't start. It had something to do with it overheating, Señor Castillo had said. Amara was pouring seawater over it, trying to cool it. Meanwhile, Iván and Isabel had been tasked with scooping the water back out of the bottom of the boat. The sock stuffed into the bullet hole was soaked through, and it drip, drip, dripped water onto Castro's face at the bottom of the boat like a leaky faucet. They had been drifting north in the Gulf Stream with the motor silent for more than an hour now, and no one was singing or dancing or laughing anymore. Ahead of Isabel, her mother and Señora Castillo slept against each other on the narrow bench at the front of the boat, where the prow came to a point. Lito sat on the middle bench, right above Isabel and Iván.
"You do have family in Miami,"
Isabel's grandfather told her, as she and Iván worked.
"When that news lady asked you if you had family in El Norte, you said no, but you do,"
Lito said.
"My brother, Guillermo."
Isabel and Iván looked up at each other in surprise. "I didn't know you had a brother," Isabel said to her grandfather.
"He left in the airlifts in the 1970s, the Freedom Flights, when the U.S. airlifted political dissidents off the island,"
Lito explained.
"But Guillermo was no dissident. He just wanted to live in the U.S. I could have gone too. I was a police officer once, like Luis and Amara. Did you know that? Back before Castro, when Batista was president."
Isabel knew that, and that Lito had lost his job during the revolution and been sent to cut cane in the fields instead.
"I could have pulled strings," Lito said, "called in favors, gotten me and your grandmother off the island."
"Then you would have been born in El Norte," Iván told Isabel.
She paused in her scooping, thinking how different her life might be right now. Born in the United States. It was almost inconceivable.
"We stayed because Cuba was our home," Lito said. "I didn't leave when Castro took over in 1959. I didn't leave when the U.S. sent planes in the 70s. And I didn't leave in the 80s when all those people sailed out of Mariel Harbor."
Lito shook his head at the tight cluster of people worrying over the engine at the back of the boat and thumped his fist against the side.
"It was a mistake leaving on this sinking coffin. I should have stayed put. All of us should have. How is Cuba worse now than it ever was? We've always been beholden to somebody else. First it was Spain. Then it was the U.S., then it was Russia. First Batista, then Castro. We should have waited. Things change. They always change."
"But do they ever get better?"
Iván asked. Isabel thought that was a good question. All her life, things had only gotten worse. First the Soviet Union collapsing, then her parents fighting, then her father trying to leave. Then her grandmother dying. She waited for Lito to tell her different, to tell her that things would get better. Isabel and Iván shared a glance. Lito's silence was answer enough.
"Someone would have done something," Lito said at last. "We should have waited."
"But they were going to arrest Papi," said Isabel.
"I know you love your father, Chabela, but he's a fool."
Isabel's cheeks burned hot with anger and embarrassment. She loved Lito, but she loved her papi, too, and she hated to hear Lito say bad things about him. But even worse, he was saying these things in front of her best friend. She glanced quickly at Iván. He kept his eyes on his work, pretending not to have heard. But they were right at Lito's feet. He could hear everything. And Lito wasn't finished.
"He's risking his life for this. He's risking your life, and your mother's life, and his unborn child's life. And for what?"
Lito asked.
"He doesn't even know. He can't say. Ask him why he wants to go to the States, and all he can say is freedom. That's not a plan. How is he going to put a roof over your head and food on your table any better than he did in Cuba?"
Lito raised his eyebrows at Isabel.
"He's taking you away from who you are. What you are. How are you ever going to learn to count clave in Miami? The U.S. has no soul. In Havana, you would have learned it without even trying. Clave is the hidden heartbeat of the people, beneath whatever song Batista or Castro is playing.
Oh, hush, Papi, Isabel's mother said sleepily. She had been awake enough to hear them after all, at least the last part. Miami is just North Cuba.
Mommy shifted and went back to sleep, but Isabel worried that Lito was right. She had never been able to count clave, but she had always assumed it would come to her eventually, that the rhythm of her homeland would one day whisper its secrets to her soul. But would she ever hear it now? Like trading her trumpet, had she swapped the one thing that was really hers, her music, for the chance to keep her family together?
We should go back, Lito said.
He wobbled to his feet.
We're not too far gone, and with Castro being so lenient right now, we won't be punished for leaving.
No, Lito, Isabel said.
No. As much as she feared the loss of her music, her soul, she wouldn't trade that for her family. She grabbed Lito and held him back.
Don't! We can't go back. They'll arrest Papi.
Panic rose like the distant rumble of thunder in Isabel's ears. But then Ivan and Lito both looked up like they could hear it too. It wasn't Isabel's fear that shook her deep down to the pit of her stomach. It was the enormous tanker headed right for them.
Mahmoud, Izmir, Turkey, 2015. 4 days from home. Mahmoud stood in a wet parking lot with his family, a light drizzle making everything slick and damp. Down past a pebbly brown beach, the Mediterranean Sea churned like a washing machine. A huge black and red cargo ship slid by on the horizon.
No, no boat today, the Syrian man who was working for the Turkish smugglers told them. Tomorrow.
But I was told it would be today, Mahmoud's father said. We hurried to get here today.
The smuggler raised a hand and shook his head. No, no. You have money, yes? Tomorrow. You will get a text tomorrow.
But where are we supposed to go?
Mahmoud's mother asked the smuggler.
Mahmoud couldn't believe it. They had spent 2 long days in cars and buses, trying to get here on time for the boat Dad had hired to take them across the sea to Greece. And now there was no boat.
There's a hotel on the next block, the smuggler said. They take Syrians.
We're trying to save money. We're going all the way to Germany, Dad told him.
There's a park nearby, the smuggler said.
A park? You mean sleep outside? But I have a baby, Mom said, gesturing to Hana in her arms.
The smuggler shrugged as if it didn't matter to him. His phone rang and he turned away to take it. Tomorrow, he told Mahmoud's parents over his shoulder. You will get a text tomorrow. Be ready. Mahmoud's father huffed, but immediately turned to his family and put on a smile.
Well, we always talked about taking a Mediterranean vacation, he said. We've got an extra night in Izmir. Who wants to go out dancing?
I just want to find some place dry where I can sleep, said Mom.
Dad led them in the direction of the hotel. All the shops were closing as they walked back through town, but Mahmoud marveled at how clean everything looked here in Turkey. There was no rubble, no twisted metal. The cobblestone streets were in perfect condition, and flowers grew in front of perfect little houses and shops. Shining cars and vans drove past on the road, and lights glowed in the windows of buildings.
Do you remember when it used to be like this in Syria? Mahmoud asked his little brother.
Walid was gawking just as much as Mahmoud, but he didn't say anything. Mahmoud took a deep, frustrated breath. He and Walid had had their fights. They were brothers, after all. But ever since Mahmoud could remember, Walid had been more like his best friend and constant companion. They played together, prayed together, shared a bedroom together. Walid had been the hyper one, bouncing off walls and hopping on furniture and kicking soccer balls in the hall.
As annoying as his brother had been sometimes, Mahmud wished he would show a little of the old crazy again. Not even the ninja turtle that Mahmud had bought for him in Kilis had cheered Walid up. Later in the hotel lobby, Mahmud was still thinking about how he could get his brother back when he heard the desk clerk say they had no rooms left. "Maybe someone will share with us," Mahmud's father suggested to the clerk.
"You will forgive me," said the desk clerk,
"but the rooms already have three families apiece." Mahmud's heart sank. Three families in each room! And the hotel was full! What were the chances they would find a room anywhere else? Dad searched on his phone and tried calling around, but it was the same story everywhere.
"But how can they be so full?" Mahmud's mother said. "They can't all be leaving tomorrow."
With nowhere else to go, they found the park the smuggler had told them about. But there was no room for them there either. All the other refugees who had been turned away from the hotels were there, some sleeping on benches in the rain, others lucky enough to have tents that looked like they had been there for more than a day or two. Mahmud slumped in the rain. He was so wet, so tired. He just wanted somewhere warm and dry to sleep.
"We should have stayed at the refugee camp," Mom said.
"No," said his father, "no, we move forward. Always forward. And we don't stop until we get to Germany. We don't want to end up stuck in this place. Let's just see if we can find a dry spot for the night."
Mahmud spied a thin Syrian boy about his age, approaching each of the families in the park, offering them something. Mahmud wandered closer to have a look. The boy saw his interest and came over to him.
"Want to buy some tissues?" the boy asked.
He offered Mahmud a small, unopened plastic pack of tissues. "Just 10 Syrian pounds or 10 Turkish kurush.
"No, thank you," Mahmud said. "Do you need water? Life vests? A phone charger?
I can get it for you, for a price."
"We need a place to stay," Mahmud said.
The boy looked Mahmud and his family over.
"I know a place," the boy said. "I will show you for 2,000 Syrian pounds, or 25 Turkish lira.
2,000 Syrian pounds was almost $10 American. A lot of money when you had a whole continent to cross. But the rain was getting stronger, and there was no place dry left in the park. When Mahmud told his father the boy's offer, Dad was willing to pay. The boy led them away from the coast to a neighborhood where weeds grew up through the cobblestones and the houses had metal grates on the windows instead of flower boxes. One of the street lamps flickered, giving the street an ominous energy. The boy lifted a broken chain-link fence that led to a parking lot.
"Here," he said.
Mahmud's father gave the rest of his family a dubious look and led them under the fence. They followed the boy to a large square building with boarded-up windows and graffiti-covered walls. One of the boards blocking the door from trespassers had been ripped off, and they pushed their way inside. It was a mall. Or it had been once. A large open courtyard with an empty fountain in the middle was ringed with storefronts that went up for 4 levels. A few of the shops were lit up with lamps connected to extension cords, and others burned kerosene lamps and candles. But most of the shops weren't shops anymore. They were little apartments where people lived. Squatters in an abandoned shopping mall. The boy led them to an empty yogurt shop on the 3rd floor, next to a former music store that was home to a Syrian family of 6. They looked like they had been there a while. They had a tattered old couch and a hot plate, and sheets hung from ropes to quarter the space into little rooms. The yogurt shop had no furniture and a broken linoleum floor. Something skittered away in the darkness when they went inside.
"It's just for the night," Mahmud's father said.
"You leave tomorrow?" the boy said.
"On a boat? Then you need life vests, most definitely, or else you drown when your boat flips."
Mahmud's eyes went wide, and he shivered in his soaking wet clothes. He didn't like any part of this plan. His father raised his hands to his family.
"The boat isn't going to flip," he told them.
"Or run out of gas, or wreck on the rocks," the boy said. "Then you drown."
Dad sighed. All right, all right. Where do we buy life vests?
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 11 days from home. Joseph's mother grabbed for his father's flailing arms, but Aaron Landau was too strong for her, thin as he was.
No, no! They're coming for us, he said, his eyes frantic. The ship is slowing down. Can't you feel it? We're slowing so they can turn us around, take us back to Germany.
Joseph's father pulled his arm away and knocked over a lamp. It fell to the floor with a crash, and the light went out.
Joseph, help me, his mother begged.
Joseph pulled himself away from the wall and tried to grab one of his father's arms while his mother went for the other. In the corner of her bed, Ruthie buried her face in Bitsy's ears and cried.
No, Joseph's father cried. We have to hide. Do you hear me? We can't stay here. We have to get off this ship.
Joseph grabbed his father's arm and held on tight.
No, Papa, we're not turning around, Joseph said. We're slowing for a funeral. A funeral at sea.
Joseph's father stopped dead, but Joseph kept a tight hold on him. He hadn't wanted to tell his father about the funeral, but now it seemed the only way to calm him down. Aaron Landau's bulging, haunted eyes swept to his son.
A funeral? Who's died? A passenger? It was the Nazis who did it. I knew they were on board. They're after us all.
He began to thrash again, more panicked than before.
No, Papa, no, Joseph said. He fought to hold on to his father. It was an old man, Professor Weiler. He was sick when he came aboard. It's not the Nazis, Papa.
Joseph knew all about it. Ruthie had begged him to go swimming in the pool with her and Renata and Evelina that afternoon, but Joseph was a man now, not a boy. He was too old for kids' stuff. He'd been walking the outside boardwalk on B-deck instead, keeping an eye out for the man from the engine room, Sheendick, and his friends, when he'd heard a cry from one of the cabin portholes. Peeking inside, he saw a woman with long, curly black hair and a white dress, sobbing, as she lay across the body of an old man. Captain Schroeder and the ship's doctor were there, too. The man in the bed was perfectly still, his mouth open and his eyes staring blankly at the ceiling. He was dead. Joseph had never seen a dead body so close up before.
You there, boy!
Joseph had jumped. A woman walking her little dog on the boardwalk on B-deck had caught him peeping. He had sprinted away as the little dog barked at him, but not before Joseph heard the ship's doctor say that Professor Weiler had died of cancer. In his family's cabin now, a few hours later, Joseph still clung to his father's arm, trying to calm him down.
He was an old man, and he'd been sick for a long time already, Joseph told his father. They're burying him at sea because we're too far away from Cuba.
Joseph and his mother hung on to his father until Joseph's words finally got through. Papa stopped struggling against them and sagged, and suddenly they were holding him up off the floor.
He was sick already? Papa asked.
Yes, it was the cancer, Joseph said.
Joseph's father let them guide him to his bed, where he sat down. Mama went to Ruthie to comfort her.
When is the funeral? Papa asked.
Late tonight, Joseph told him.
I want to go, his father said.
Joseph couldn't believe it. Papa hadn't left the cabin in 11 days, and now he wanted to go to the funeral of someone he'd never met? In his condition? Joseph looked worriedly to his mother, who held Ruthie in her lap.
I don't think that's such a good idea, Mama said, echoing Joseph's thoughts.
I saw too many men die without funerals at Dachau, Papa said. I will go to this one.
It was the first time his father had even spoken the name of the place he'd been, and it was like a winter frost covered everything in the room. It ended the conversation as quickly as it had begun.
Take Joseph with you, then, Mama said. Ruthie and I will stay here.
That night, Joseph led his father to A-deck aft, where the captain and his first officer waited with a few other passengers. The passengers' clothes looked shabby, and it was only when he heard his father tearing his shirt that Joseph understood. Ripping your garments was a Jewish tradition at funerals, and they had torn theirs in sympathy with Mrs. Viler. Joseph pulled on his own collar until the seam ripped. His father nodded, then led him to the sandbox by the pool and had him take a handful of sand. Joseph didn't understand, but he did as he was told. The elevator to A deck arrived, and Mrs. Viler emerged first, a candle in hand. Behind her came the rabbi and four sailors who carried Professor Viler's body on a stretcher. He was bound up tight in a white sailcloth like an Egyptian pharaoh.
"Hold on there."
The man from below decks, Schindick, pushed through the small crowd with two fellow crew members.
"I'm Otto Schindick, the Nazi party leader on this ship," he said, "and German law says that a body buried at sea must be covered with the national flag."
Schindick unfurled the red and white Nazi flag with the black swastika in the middle, and the passengers gasped. Papa pushed his way forward.
"Never! Do you hear me? Never! It's a sacrilege!"
He was shaking worse than ever. Joseph had never seen his father this angry, and he was frightened for him. Schindick wasn't the kind of man you wanted to mess with. Joseph grabbed his father's arm and tried to pull him away. Papa spat at the feet of Schindick.
"That is what I think of you and your flag."
Schindick and his men surged forward to avenge the insult, but Captain Schroeder quickly intervened.
"Stop this! Stop this at once! Steward!"
Captain Schroeder commanded. Schindick addressed his captain, but never took his eyes off Joseph's father.
"It's German law, and I see no reason for an exception to be made in this case." "And I do," Captain Schroeder said. "Now, take that flag and leave here, Mr. Schindick, or I will relieve you of duty and have you confined to quarters."
The steward held Papa's gaze a long moment more. His eyes shifted to Joseph, giving him goosebumps, and then Schindick turned and stormed away. Joseph's chest heaved like he'd been running a marathon. He was so wound up he was quivering worse than his father. Sand slipped from his shaking fist. The captain apologized profusely for the disturbance, and the funeral continued. The rabbi said a short prayer in Hebrew, and the sailors slid the body of Professor Viler over the side of the ship. After a moment, there was a quiet splash, and the mourners said together, "Remember, God, that we are of dust." One by one they stepped to the rail, where they released handfuls of sand, the sand Joseph's father had told him to take from the sandbox. Joseph joined his father at the rail, and they scattered their sand in the sea. Captain Schroeder and his first officer put their caps back on and saluted. They touched the brims of their hats, Joseph noticed, instead of giving the Hitler salute. Without words, the funeral service broke up. Joseph expected his father to return to their cabin right away, but instead he lingered at the rail, staring down into the dark waters of the Atlantic. "What is he thinking?" Joseph wondered. "What happened to him at Dachau that he's now a ghost of the man he once was?" "At least he didn't have to be buried in the hell of the Third Reich," his father said. The ship rumbled softly, and Joseph knew the captain had restarted the engines. They were on their way to Cuba again. But how much time had they lost?
Isabel, The Straits of Florida, Somewhere North of Cuba, 1994. One day from home. The tanker emerged from the darkness like some giant leviathan come to swallow them. It stood at least 7 stories tall out of the water and was so wide it filled the horizon. Its pointed bow sent huge waves sluicing away, and 2 massive anchors stood out from the sides like the horns on a monster. Isabel quailed in fear. It was straight out of a nightmare.
"A ship!" Lito yelled. "We've drifted into the shipping lanes!"
But by now, everyone had seen it. The rumble of the ship's massive engines had awakened Mommy and Senora Castillo, and everyone was scrambling around in the boat in a panic, making it rock dangerously.
"It's coming right for us!" Amara screamed.
Isabel climbed over Ivan, trying to get as far away from the tanker as she could. She slipped and fell with a splash into the bottom of the boat.
"Everybody settle down,"
Señor Castillo cried, but no one was listening.
We have to get the engine started,
Papi cried. He yanked frantically on the starter chain, barely giving the engine time to cough and die before he yanked on it again.
Don't! You'll flood it and it'll never start, Luis said,
trying to wrestle the chain from him.
Where are the matches? Lito cried. We have to start a fire. They can't see us in the dark.
Here, said Iván. He lifted a matchbox from the styrofoam carton that held the few emergency supplies they'd brought.
No!
Papi yelled. He lunged for Iván's outstretched hand, and together they fell against the side of the boat, tipping it. Isabel's mother fell into the pool of water on the bottom and slid into the side of the boat with a thump. Isabel crawled to help her. Lito grabbed Papi by the shirt.
What are you doing?
He demanded. Papi held the matchbox out of Lito's reach.
We don't want to be seen, you old fool,
he yelled over the growing thunder of the tanker.
If they see us, they'll have to rescue us. It's maritime law. And if they rescue us, they'll send us back to Cuba. Would you rather they send us to the ocean floor?
Lito yelled. Isabel couldn't help looking up as she pulled her mother out of the water.
It's getting closer, Isabel cried.
The tanker was still hundreds of meters away, but it was so huge it felt like it was on top of them. They were never getting out of its way. Isabel's heart thumped so hard she thought it was going to burst right out of her chest.
If we don't want them to know we're here, maybe we shouldn't start the engine,
Amara yelled.
They'll never hear us no matter what we do,
Señor Castillo said. The tanker was so loud now it sounded like a jet engine. He and Luis flipped a switch on their own engine and yanked the starter chain again. A puff of gray smoke poofed out from the engine, but it didn't catch. The tanker loomed larger, closer. Isabel cringed. It was going to hit them. Luis yanked on the chain. A cough, a sputter, nothing. Cough, sputter, nothing. Cough, sputter, nothing. The sea swelled in front of the tanker, pushing them higher and away, and for a fleeting moment, Isabel's hopes rose with it. But then the swell passed, and they were pulled back in by the tanker's massive draw. Their little blue boat spun sideways, and they zoomed toward the big ship's prow. The tanker was going to tear them in half, right down the middle. Isabel looked up into the terrified eyes of Iván as he realized the same thing, and they screamed. Then suddenly they were both thrown to the bottom of the boat, and something buzzed like a mosquito underneath the howl of the tanker. Luis had gotten the engine to start. Their little boat shot forward in the water, darting out of the way of the tanker's prow. But the waves thrown off by the big ship lifted up the back end of Isabel's boat and dumped an ocean of seawater on top of them. Isabel swallowed a mouthful of salty water and tumbled across the boat. She slammed into something hard, and her shoulder exploded with pain. She came up spluttering. She was hip-deep in water, and the engine had stopped again. But none of that mattered right now. Iván's father had fallen overboard. Isabel saw his white-haired head rise up out of the water. Señor Castillo gulped for air, then disappeared as a wave from the massive tanker's wake rolled over him.
Señor Castillo!
Isabel cried.
Papa!
Iván shouted.
Where is he? Do you see him?
Isabel and Iván frantically searched the dark water, watching for Señor Castillo to surface again. They had missed the huge ship's prow by mere meters, but the waves the behemoth created as it passed were just as dangerous. The ocean heaved and sank, the little boat tipping over sideways as the waves caught it amidships. Everyone was just getting back up from the floor of the boat when they were sent tumbling again. Iván rolled to the other side of the boat, but Isabel hung on.
There,
She saw Señor Castillo's head pop up from under the water, but only for a gasping second, too quick to get enough air. In a flash, Isabel remembered her grandmother disappearing under the waves just like that 2 years ago, and without another thought, Isabel dove in after Señor Castillo.
Mahmoud, Izmir, Turkey, 2015, 11 days from home. Mahmoud screamed. He howled louder than a fighter jet, and his parents didn't even tell him to hush. Lights came on in houses nearby, and curtains ruffled as people looked out at the noise. Mahmoud's mother broke down in tears, and his father let the life jackets he carried drop to the ground. The smuggler had just told them their boat wasn't leaving tonight. Again.
No boat today. Tomorrow. Tomorrow, he told Mahmoud's father.
It was exactly the same thing he told Mahmoud's father the day before, and the day before that, and every day for the last week. A text would come telling them to hurry, hurry, out to the beach, and every time they would pack up what few things they owned, grab the life jackets, and rush through the streets of Izmir to this parking lot, and every time there would be no boat waiting for them. First it was the weather, the smuggler said. Then another family that was supposed to go with them hadn't arrived yet. Then it was the Turkish Coast Guard patrols, or the boat wasn't ready. There was always some reason they couldn't leave. It was like some cruel schoolyard game of keep away. Mahmoud and his family were at their wits' end. This off-and-on-again business was tearing them apart. All except for Walid. Lifeless Walid, who didn't flinch when bombs exploded.
I want to go back to Syria. I don't care if we die, Mahmoud said after he let out his scream. I just want to get out of here.
Even as he said it, he heard the whine in his voice, the pathetic toddler-like frustration. Part of him was embarrassed. He was older than that, more mature. He was almost a man. But another part of him just wanted to stomp his feet and pitch a fit, and that part of him was getting harder and harder to keep quiet. Little Hannah started crying too, and Mahmoud's mother tried to calm them both by pulling Mahmoud into a hug.
Look at it this way, Dad said. Now we have more time to practice our Turkish.
No one laughed.
Let's get back to the mall before someone takes our place, Mom said wearily.
Mahmoud carried the life jackets so his father could carry Walid, who quickly fell asleep on his father's shoulder. His mother carried Hannah. Even though Mahmoud hated the desperate feeling of defeat in going back to the mall, at least it meant not sleeping outside in the park. But this time, someone was waiting for them at the mall entrance. There were two of them, both Turkish men, in matching blue tracksuits. One of them was muscular with curly black hair, a thin beard, and a thick gold chain necklace. The other was overweight and wore mirrored sunglasses, even though it was night. He was the one with the pistol stuck in the waist of his pants.
You want inside? You gotta pay rent, the burly man told them.
Since when? Mahmoud's father said.
Since now, the man said. We own this building, and we're tired of you Syrians freeloading.
More bullies, thought Mahmoud, just like in Syria. Mahmoud's legs went numb, and he thought he might fall over. He couldn't bear the thought of walking any farther, looking for a place to live again.
How much? Mahmoud's father asked wearily. £5,000 a night, the muscular man said.
Dad sighed and started to put Walid down so he could pay the man.
Each, the man said.
Each? Per night? Dad said. Mahmoud knew his dad was doing the math in his head. There were five of them, and they'd already been here a week. How long could they afford to pay £25,000 a day and still have enough for the boat and whatever came afterward?
No, Mahmoud's father said.
Mom started to protest, but he shook his head.
No! We already have all our things. We'll find someplace else to stay. It's only until tomorrow.
The big man chuckled.
Right, tomorrow.
Mahmoud staggered along behind his parents as they roamed the streets of Izmir looking for some place to sleep. His parents carried Walid and Hana, but not him. He was too old to be carried anymore, and for the first time, he wished he wasn't. They finally found the doorway of a travel agency set back from the street, and no one else was sleeping there. They were just settling in when a Turkish police car came down the street. Mahmud shrank back into the corner, trying to be invisible, but the police car's lights came on, and it beeped its electronic siren at them. Bloop, bloop! You can't sleep here, a police officer told them through a loudspeaker. And so they had to get up and walk again. Mahmud was so tired he started to cry, but he did it softly so his parents wouldn't hear. He hadn't cried like this since that first night when the bombs had started to fall on Aleppo. Another car came down the road, and at first Mahmud worried it was another police car. But it was a BMW sedan. On a whim, Mahmud darted out into the car's headlights and waved the life jackets on his arms. "Mahmud, no!" his mother cried. The BMW slowed, its lights bright in his face. The driver honked at him, and Mahmud hurried around to the driver's side window. "Please, can you help us?" Mahmud begged. "My baby sister..." But the car was already shooting away. Another car followed it, and it drove right past Mahmud. "Mahmud, get out of the street!" his father called. "You'll get yourself killed!" Mahmud didn't care anymore. There had to be someone who would help them. He waved the life jackets at the next car, and miraculously it stopped. It was an old brown Skoda, and the driver rolled the window down by hand. He was an elderly, wrinkled man with a short white beard, and he wore a black-and-white keffiyeh headscarf. "Please, can you help us?" Mahmud asked. "My family and I have nowhere to go, and my sister is only a baby." Dad jogged up and tried to pull Mahmud away. "We're very sorry," Mahmud's father told the man. "We didn't mean to bother you. We'll be on our way."